Hello, this is Debbie, coming to you on Wednesday, November 11th, 2015, Veterans Day, with the Decatur Papers, starting with the Herald and Review. Top of the page story, House Governor stirred to life on some budget issues. This is from Kirk Erickson, of the Springfield H&R Bureau. Springfield. Democrats and Republicans came together Tuesday in support of a plan to send gas tax proceeds to Illinois cities, as well as jumpstart payments to lottery winners and local 9/11 emergency telephone systems. But even with the scent of compromise in the air, under the gridlock State House dome, members of each party were still fighting their bitter battle over some issues, sending the timeline for reaching an elusive budget deal into 2016. On a 115-1 vote, the Illinois House approved a $1.9 billion spending package designed to send motor fuel tax dollars to municipalities that have been blocked because of the lingering budget impasse between Democrats in the General Assembly and Republican Governor Bruce Rauner. Mayors have been complaining that the state-level fight could leave them unable to battle winter weather or to provide other needed services to their constituents. The measure would also bring to an end the nationally embarrassing fiasco in which lottery winners aren't being paid. The money, however, won't be flowing anytime soon. The Senate is not scheduled to be in town for the remainder of the year, although members could return to the Capitol on short notice. We're still a long ways away from a final resolution, said House Speaker Michael Madigan, Democrat, Chicago. Approval of the measure came a day after Rauner lifted a hold on the proposal as part of a series of compromises designed to signal progress in the long-running budget fight that has left the state without a spending blueprint since July 1st. Along with the spending package, reversals announced by Rauner included easing restrictions on who qualifies for a state-financed child care program that had given Democrats ammunition to paint Rauner as uncaring to the poor, finding a middle ground between business groups and labor on changes to unemployment insurance laws, which have been a key tenet of his business-friendly agenda, and ending his attempt to limit who qualifies for a program that brings health services to the elderly and disabled. Rauner described Tuesday as a day of progress, but, he said, the General Assembly still needs to approve his proposals to weaken labor unions, a demand that has been rejected thus far by Democrats who control the House and the Senate, leaving the state without a budget. While we made progress today by working together, we did not accomplish all that we could, and the biggest issues remain. We still need major structural and economic reforms, Rauner said. On successive party line votes, the House fell one vote short of approving the compromises that would have eased Rauner-imposed restrictions on who qualifies for child care subsidies and the services benefiting the elderly and disabled. Republicans said the votes were another attempt by Madigan to force them into bad votes that would be used against them in the 2016 election cycle. State Representative Bill Mitchell, Republican Forsyth, did not cast a vote on the child care measure. I think it's all about us taking bad votes, Mitchell said. It's obvious progress is made, and this is the Democrats sticking it in the eye of the governor, added State Representative Tim Butler, Republican, Springfield. The governor was the one who compromised. By contrast, Democrats in the House said they were surprised Republicans would vote against legislation that would lift the limits on child care programs, affecting tens of thousands of low-income parents and children. I can't imagine anyone voting against this bill, said State Representative Sue Scher, Democrat, Decatur. In the Senate, lawmakers on both sides of the aisle were encouraged by Rauner's effort to compromise. State Senator Andy Manar, Democrat, Bunker Hill, said it appeared progress was being made toward breaking the gridlock. He said he's waiting a November 18th meeting of Rauner and the four legislative leaders to see if more roadblocks can be removed. What has happened this week is a step in the right direction, Manar said. State Senator Chapin Rose, Republican Mohammed said the governor's maneuvers were a good faith effort toward finding a resolution. This isn't going to break the entire logjam, but it's nice to see a little movement on everyone's part, Rose said. End of article. Next front page article. Vietnam veteran proud of his men, family tradition. This is by D. Beckett. Danette Beckett from the H&R staff. Decatur. James Heard is part of a military family. With his father serving in World War II, a grandfather in World War I, and a great-great-grandfather in Civil War, he seemed destined to serve his country. Little did he know what would be expected of him and others who would fight in Vietnam. Heard was drafted into the Army and quickly rose to sergeant during his 13 months in the war. He was stationed in La Khi and Quan Loi from November 1966 to February 1968, but stayed at the airbase camps on only three occasions. The rest of his service was spent in the jungle. An average daily patrol was about 5 miles in the dense brush and humidity. Soldiers would have to cut their way through the jungle with machetes. When they returned to a post at night, they would cut leeches off of each other. The jungle was covered with leeches and fire ants and poisonous snakes, Heard said. If the Viet Cong crap didn't get to the environment would. His time in war may have been hazardous, but Heard also remembers the soldiers who did their job. My guys, they ran to where the action was, he said. They didn't hide. Heard still has great pride in the men with whom he served. Every one of them made Rambo look like a slacker, he said, referring to the action movie character played by Sylvester Stallone. During one mission, Heard said he and his platoon killed 600 Vietnamese soldiers in 3.5 hours. Although these battles were routine for the men, Heard is not ashamed. I regret what I had to do, but it was what I had to do, he said. Little kids I've seen since wouldn't have had the opportunity if we hadn't been there. Heard was a member of the Big Red One. The 1st Infantry Division was given this. Heard was a member of the Big Red One. The 1st Infantry Division was given this nickname and others, including the Bloody One, because of the red numeral one on the shoulder patch. But the soldiers knew the name have a different meaning. Blood, sweat, tears, anxiety, and fear, Norman Ross said of his time with the 1st Infantry Division. Jim Hicks was one of the first troops to fight with the Big Red One in 1965, when President Johnson decided to upgrade the war, he said. We did the fighting, Heard said. I was in every major battle during my time in Vietnam. Operation Shenandoah II was particularly terrifying for the young soldier and his men. Brigadier General Bernard W. Rogers acknowledged Heard during an award ceremony for his actions in the battle. His courage and aggressiveness under hostile fire contributed significantly to the safe withdrawal of his unit and undoubtedly saved many lives, he said. Rogers gave details of the battle and Heard's responsibility in the attack, including the enemy field of fire and the danger ensued. He then began to drag friendly wounded soldiers from the danger area, he said. He made several trips, exposing himself to intense hostile fire, each time until all wounded had been removed to safety. Heard received the Silver Star for his actions. The veteran has since retired as a laborer and has settled in Decatur. During his time in Vietnam, he received several medals along with a Silver Star, including 2 Bronze Stars, an Army Commendation Medal, and a National Defense Service Medal. But his pride doesn't come from the sacrifices he made for his country, but from his family, which continues a tradition. The family's military service did not end with the Vietnam veteran. Heard's son served in Desert Storm, and his grandson served in Afghanistan. I have 6 generations in my family that served during wartime, he said, and all of us came home. End of that article. The next front page article is an AP article out of Milwaukee. Seeking an Edge, GOP Candidates Cover Wide Range of Issues. This is by Julie Pace and Julie Bickowitz, who are AP writers. A feisty Jeb Bush sought to regain his footing in Tuesday's Republican presidential debate, taking advantage of a policy-focused debate to detail positions on the economy and immigration, while casting himself as the strongest general election opponent for Democratic frontrunner Hillary Rodham Clinton. Mild-mannered Ben Carson also sought to steady his campaign, swatting away questions about the veracity of his celebrated biography, detailing his rise from poverty to become an acclaimed neurosurgeon. We should vet all candidates, Carson said. I have no problem with being vetted. What I do have a problem with is being lied about. The debate, the last for the GOP until mid-December, could help shape the course of the campaign into the winter as voters begin to pay more attention to the White House race. The televised contest opened with a narrow focus on economic policy, with moderators from Fox Business News allowing the candidates to deliver lengthy answers and avoiding attempts to get them to engage with one another. Bush entered the debate in need of a strong performance to ease the anxiety of donors and other supporters. He sharply criticized Clinton for defending President Barack Obama's economic policies, saying the nation must do better. Bush also stood by his call for immigration policies that would allow some of those in the U.S. illegally to find a path to legal status, while criticizing frontrunner Donald Trump's call for mass deportation as an impractical plan that would hand Democrats a talking point as they seek to appeal to Hispanic voters. They're doing high fives in the Clinton campaign when they're hearing this, Bush said. Former Governor Bush avoided tangling with fellow Floridian Marco Rubio, a shift in strategy from his poor performance in the last debate. Still, Rubio faced criticism from some rivals about whether he is a true conservative, given his call for child tax care credit and increasing military spending. We can't even have an economy if we're not safe, said Rubio, a first-term senator enjoying recent momentum for his White House bid. Rubio's call for increased military spending was backed by Trump, the real estate mogul, who has led the GOP field for months. While Trump has been a frequent critic of his rivals on the campaign trail, he looked to make his mark in the policy discussions, including opposing a new Asia-Pacific trade deal supported by many Republicans. I love trade, Trump said. I'm a free trader 100%, but we need smart people making the deals. Trump's grip on the GOP field has been challenged in recent weeks by Carson, another outsider. As Carson has risen in preference polls, however, he has faced a flurry of questions about his biography, which has been central to his connection with voters. While pieces of Carson's background has been challenged earlier in the campaign, the questions ballooned last week after CNN reported it could not find friends or confidants to corroborate the story, told in his widely read autobiography of his unsuccessfully trying to stab a close friend when he was a teenager. Later in the week, Politico examined Carson's claim of being offered a scholarship to attend the U.S. Military Academy, and the Wall Street Journal said it could not confirm anecdotes told by Carson about his high school and college years. The two-hour debate lurched to a slow start, with the candidates fielding questions about a variety of economic policies. Most stuck to their standard talking points and largely went unchallenged by moderators. Drawing a contrast with Democrats, the candidates voiced opposition to raising the federal minimum wage, casting it as an impediment to job growth. If you raise the minimum, you're going to make people more expensive than a machine, Rubio said. Trump concurred, saying we cannot do this if we're going to compete with the rest of the world. Clinton has called for raising the minimum wage from $7.25 to $12 an hour. Her chief rival, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders, has backed an increase to $15. Also on the stage Tuesday were Texas Senator Ted Cruz, businesswoman Carly Fiorina, Ohio Governor John Kasich, and Kentucky Senator Rand Paul. Missing from the lineup were New Jersey Governor Chris Christie and former Arkansas Governor Mike Huckabee. Both were dropped from the top tier of debate with low poll numbers in national surveys, sparking criticism for the way networks hosting the debate have determined participation. Christie and Huckabee instead appeared in the undercard debate, along with Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal and former Pennsylvania Senator Rick Santorum. Christie tried to cast himself as well-prepared for a general election, focusing more on Clinton than fellow Republicans. She believes she can make decisions for you better than you can make them for yourself, Christie said of Clinton. End of article. And the last article on the front page, Golf Facing Rough Future in Decatur. Golf numbers give Park District pause. This is by Allison Petty, an H&R staff writer. Decatur. The grim realities of Decatur's golf climate could lead Decatur Park District leaders to contemplate closing a course, Executive Director Bill Clevenger said Tuesday. The discussion came as part of the district's annual golf focus group meeting at Scoville Golf Course Banquet Facility. Golfers filled the room to hear a presentation of the status of the golf program and provide their input about its future. The district owns Hickory Point Golf Course, Red Trail Run Golf Course, and Scoville Golf Course. What's golf going to look like in the future? Are we going to be able to sustain golf the way it looks today? Clevenger said after the meeting. If you look at the national trends and look at the trends in Decatur, it would tell you probably not. Park Board President Jack Kenny said no decision had been made despite ongoing rumors about a potential closure. I think we're going to talk about financing in the future, he said. Whether that entails closing a course or not, I don't know. I think we've got budget questions coming up, and we'll see. Overall, data presented a bleak picture. Despite cuts to staff and other expenses and continued efforts to diversify offerings, the courses continue to lose money. Golf's decline in the city is a reflection of national trends, with course closings having outpaced openings for the ninth consecutive year, Clevenger said. And the game generally isn't drawing young people. One golfer asked directly about the possibility of closing Scoville Golf Course and what could be done with the banquet facility in that scenario. I don't think there's been any decisions made, but it will be a topic of decision going forward, how we're going to create a sustainable future, Clevenger answered. The reality of it is we're going to have to talk about that. We have to talk about sustaining an entire park system. Speaking after the meeting, Clevenger said Scoville would be the most logical option if district leaders did decide to close the course. Given the participation numbers, given all the indicators that you would use in making a decision, I think it would probably be the first place you would look. I think we have to talk all the way through that and determine what the future would be. The three golf courses together will see an expected 68,266 rounds this fiscal year, according to the district's presentation. This represents a dramatic decrease from 190,000 rounds in 1990. Golf is just one of the district's offerings, some of which attract more people. Scoville Zoo drew 108,000 visitors in 2015, and Decatur Indoor Sports Center had more than 110 visits. Overlook Adventure Miniature Golf Course had more than 36,000 rounds. The district's youth baseball and soccer offerings are also very popular, officials said. Slow income growth, population decline, and competition from more than 100 courses with carts, about 52% of the available 198,088 tee times have gone unfilled. An analysis of golf revenue and expenses over the past decade showed an average annual operating loss of $227.232. With the inclusion of capital expenses, the annual golf subsidy was $715,523. Several golfers suggested some type of discount, such as cheaper rates in the afternoons or lower cart fees to encourage more play. District officials did reduce fees at Scoville to $29 for 18 holes with a cart this year in an effort to draw more players. While rounds at Scoville increased, play at the other two courses decreased, officials have said. The numbers also were not high enough at Scoville to make up the discount. You have to look at when you reduce prices, you have to increase volume, Clevenger said. Right now in our environment, we're really not increasing volume. John Davis, a former candidate for Park Board, suggested that the district pursue more competitive tournaments and adding video gambling. The latter comment drew some chuckles from the crowd. Okay, we laugh, but gambling machines are very popular and they bring in a lot of revenue, Davis said. Wes Hillen, assistant men's golf coach for Millikan University and one of the event's younger attendees, said he didn't think gambling or small price adjustments were the answer. Instead, he said the district must find ways to attract young adults who would eventually raise their children with the sport. When it comes down to it, it really is the younger kids, he said. Steve Meyervold, 72, has been playing golf in Decatur since he was 12. He typically plays at Hickory Point and said most golfers choose that course or Red Tail Run. In a comment card he filled out after the meeting, Meyervold wrote, "If you close Scoville, it's fine with me. I think most people will not have a problem." Anyone who has suggestions for the Park District's golf program can contact the district's administration office at 422-5911 or email Lisa Gillen at lgillen@decparks.com. So that's LGILLEN at decparks.com. NewsWire.com. That is the end of that article and the end of the front page. Continuing to the local section, school board votes union support. This is by Valerie Wells, H&R staff writer from Decatur. The Decatur School Board approved signing onto an amicus brief in a U.S. Supreme Court case regarding collective bargaining units during its meeting Tuesday night. An amicus brief is an opportunity for a person with strong interest in a case to offer information to the court without being a party to the case. The U.S. Supreme Court is hearing a challenge to its 40-year-old precedent permitting public sector unions to compel non-members to pay service fees, Friedrich versus California Teachers Association. Union supporters are concerned overturning the precedent would further weaken their membership. Board member Alita Graham, who formerly served as president of the Decatur Education Association, said the request to join the amicus brief came from the National Education Association. "I believe we're a better district when we have a strong collective bargaining units in our state," she said. Other board members agreed with her. Board member B.A. Butts called collective bargaining a check and balances system. "You develop a more personal rapport and interest-based bargaining," said board member Dan Oakes, who has been involved in a number of contract negotiations. All board members voted in favor of signing on to the amicus brief. In other business, the school district will have a new director of building and grounds as of June. Mike Sutteroff, who has served in the position for several years, will retire at the end of the year. Until then, James Gortner will serve as Assistant Director of Buildings and Grounds. Gortner thanked the board for its confidence in him and said he will represent the district with vigor and look forward to learning under Sutteroff's leadership for the remainder of the school year. Mel Restio, Turkey Tournament Coordinator, spoke to the board about this year's tournament, which will be held at MacArthur High School on November 24th, 25th, 27th, and 28th. This will be the tournament's 46th year. End of that article. Next, Garfield students hope to dig up prize with zombies, again by Valerie Wells, Decatur. Zombies really like Doritos. The common wisdom is that they subsist entirely on brains, but not according to Garfield Montessori School's video production students. "We're the humans," explained Ella Smith, a seventh grader at Garfield. "We're running from the zombies." The video production class at Garfield is making a Doritos commercial to enter into the annual contest for a fan-made commercial for the Super Bowl. Doritos Crash Super Bowl has a top prize of $1 million and the lowest level of St. Teresa High School, where there is a vending machine suitable for the storyline, became a movie set Thursday. I'll read that again. That doesn't make sense. That's a big, long sentence. Doritos Crash the Super Bowl has a top prize of $1 million. And the lowest level of St. Teresa High School, where there's a vending machine suitable for the storyline, became a movie set Thursday. Teacher Kevin Jones said the plot is that zombies are chasing a family running for their lives, but when they get to the vending machine, it turns out the zombies just want Doritos, and in the end, the whole group happily munches them together. If the group's commercial wins, said 8th grader Audrey Smith Phillips, the money will benefit Garfield as a whole, not just the video class, and could make a whole lot of things possible that aren't possible now. Volunteers from Mr. John's School of Cosmetology transformed some of the cast into some very realistic zombies who practiced their shuffling zombie walk prior to the filming. Part of the prize is an epic gag with Warner Brothers and DC Entertainment, and for Ella and Audrey, both of whom would like careers in such pursuits. That's a big draw, too. Avery Newsom isn't in the video class, but he was recruited to play a zombie along with his dad and said yes. "I've been in school plays," said Jake Blackburn, who was cast as one of the humans. "I like acting." End of that article. On to crime and courts on the local page. Police reel in alleged serial copper thief. This is by Tony Reed, Herald and Review staff writer. Decatur. A Decatur man police accused of being a serial copper wire thief was allegedly caught red-handed Monday morning stealing more copper from a vacant building and causing an estimated $100,000 in damage. Barry A. Mabra, 51, has served a previous one-month jail sentence and a three-year prison term in the 1990s for felony damage to electric power lines while trying to steal copper wire. Mabra is now back in the Macon County Jail on the charge of burglary after patrol officers said they arrested him as he fled from an empty building in the 100 block of West Prairie Avenue. Sworn statements say police had cornered Mabra in the building at 8:30 a.m. after being alerted by the property's owner, who dropped by for an inspection, that someone was inside. Police and a police dog surrounded the building, and it's alleged Mabra tried to make a break for it out of a door and was seen to discard a box cutter as he was running. Police said they found three receipts for recycling copper in his pants pocket after they searched him. Barry admitted to being in the building on the first floor near the door he ran out of, Officer Randy Clem wrote in the sworn statement. Barry stated he went in the building so he could smoke marijuana from a one-hitter pipe. Barry denied being in the building to steal. Clem said he checked the building over with the owner and they found several pieces of cut foam insulation lying on the floor and conduit was bent down from the ceiling. The owner explained the conduit housed copper wire, Clem said. On the second floor, several pieces of cut copper wire were found lying on the floor and outside of a window lying on a roof. Vice grips, snips, and tube cutters were found near the cut pieces of copper wire. Mabra remained in Macon County Jail on Tuesday in lieu of posting a $75,000 bond. End of that article. And then to some local briefs as we finish up part one here. Foresight, shoplifting arrests. Three men carrying small saw blades were arrested Monday evening as they allegedly tried to steal boxer briefs and other clothing from the Von Maur store in the Hickory Point Mall in Forsyth. The subjects, two aged 19 and one 18, were caught by a loss prevention officer who told Macon County Sheriff's Office deputies he'd seen all three selecting briefs and other items before walking out without paying. The man allegedly later told police the saw blades were used to cut the security tags off the merchandise so alarms wouldn't sound when they left the store. All three were booked on charges of burglary and possession of burglary tools. Next, Mount Zion Odd Fellows Scholarships. Mount Zion Odd Fellows Lodge 300 has scholarships available for students who are Illinois residents, U.S. citizens, and have a C or above grade point average who are planning to attend an accredited college or trade school. Applications must be received by Sunday, February 28th, and are available at www.ioof-il.org. The Odd Fellows. Then next, Shelbyville. Deer Hunt Volunteers. Volunteers are needed to help the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and Lake Volunteer Association at Lake Shelby with the annual deer hunt for people with disabilities Friday through Sunday, November 20th to 22nd. Volunteers will assist in helping hunters get to and from blinds, tracking, field dressing, dragging deer out of the woods, and helping around deer camp. Volunteers also are needed to help set up food, make coffee, and clean up after meals. A hunter volunteer orientation will be Thursday, November 19th. Hunt camp is based out of the Oka Bluff Group Homes on Illinois 32, south of Sullivan. For more information, call Ranger Brian Blakeway at 774-3951, 774-3951, extension 7019. This is the end of part one. November 11th, 2015, Herald Review. This is Debbie saying, talk to you soon.